kid, Mum would cut out these little cartoons in the newspaper and stick them on the fridge. And they were unlike any of the other cartoons in the newspaper that had little, they were in little boxes and they had some setup and a punchline that felt really predictable. But these little cartoons, sometimes they were wordless and they felt open-ended and you could feel almost like a breeze going through them. They'd left room for the imagination to run a little bit wild. And these cartoons were by Michael Lunick. He was a Melbourne cartoonist, Australian cartoonist. But for me as a kid, I didn't understand that a person made them. I thought, because I was like a 6 or 7, 8, I just thought that they were just created by magic. Like they were immaculately conceived. They just turned up. And there was always this little name sign down the bottom, Lunick. And then I was like, I don't know. What's with that? And for me, they made more sense than a lot of kids' books at the time. Like they were more, they tickled something inside me that made more sense than the books that were supposedly written for kids. And as kids, we're kind of part genius. So adults writing for kids, they have to kind of match kids' genius. And most 90% of them can't, or more. But Michael Lunick was doing these cartoons for the local newspaper that's distributed everywhere. And they were for adults, but they were so good, they could tickle my 8-year-old self. Heart, guts, everything. It was magic. It was like there was no other word for it. And then I found out he made books, and so I remember buying a book of his, and that felt so good to have all his drawings and words in one book. I actually remember when I got that first book of his, there was a picture of him on the back. And that didn't make sense. It was like, what? There's a human face attached that comes with these cartoons? That a human face made these things? That made no sense. So it started to demystify the magic a bit. It's the old separating the art from the artist. But yeah, I was like, oh, I'll go with it. That's all right. And Mum would stick these on the fridge and she'd go, now, Darby, what does this say to you? I remember there was one with a man reading a book sitting on a sawn-off log in some barren landscape. But instead of holding the book was on his head and he was holding his head in his hands. It was a little bit of Marguerite, I guess, in it. A little bit of surrealism. I know that now. There was a kind of a touch of The Little Prince to it, and I only know that now. I know that he was inspired by Catcher in the Rye, that sort of angsty teenager who walked around going, this is fake. That's phony. That's bullshit. And that's what he did, but he did it in his kind of in a gentle way of prodding at the walls of reality. And you could feel it. He did it so well. But it was also a time back in the 80s and the 90s where there wasn't much going around. There's nothing. Like you couldn't internet something. You couldn't Google it or find it on something interesting on the web or whatever. So he was the kind of the only thing going around. That was the only interesting outside world coming into my little world and, yeah, expanding it in a way that made sense to me, especially the wordless ones when I was really young. And then I finally got to understand his worded ones, like there's one about does Santa believe in children? And there's kind of a little bit of Monty Python sometimes to his stuff. You could feel how I was obsessed by him until I was probably mid-20s. Then I found other things. I still loved him all the way through, but up until about 25, that's when I went, okay, there's other people out here as well that I can discover. But yeah, I learned a lot from him. I almost began to study him. I went from just enjoying his magic and then studying him. I could see how he would take some very common idea, twist it a little bit, and then take it to an extreme and then twist it again. And there was always almost three twists in it until things became ridiculous and made even more sense than the thing that existed in the first place. Is it Camus or Sartre? I can't remember. I don't know my philosophers well, but just deconstructing what we just take for granted and what the walls of reality are. And he did it so well over and over again. And there was often just funny shit. Sometimes he'd just go scatological shit humor and with nakedness and all that sort of shit. But yeah, I studied him, and I felt like I was starting to learn from him, and I was going, oh, I wonder if I could recreate something like that. I wonder if I could be a cartoonist one day and make my own stuff. I remember one of his cartoons in my early 20s when I had my first job. There was a little man flying over the city. He'd been pulled away from the judge and the jury of life, and he was going to be okay. And I remember at the time I had so much anxiety in my 20s, and that cartoon at that time, in that hour, just pulled me out of my dumb head and made me feel sane for just a second. But that second was all I needed to feel slightly normal again. I remember he did a cartoon back in the early 90s about someone who went to a man who goes to visit his hero or his guru, and he says something like, I'm going to study at your feet and learn from you, and eventually I'll use everything I've learned against you, and then I'll kick you off a cliff or something like that. So I remember thinking, oh no, I'm trying to learn. I don't want to kick him off a cliff, but I remember at the age of 19, 18 going, oh, I'm learning, but I don't want to end up doing that shit. I can't remember, but there was also another one that I think for me is his most classic one. I think it was called The Journey, or How to Get There. It's actually called How to Get There. He wrote it in 1990 or 91 or some shit, from the Travelling Loony. From memory, it goes something like, how to get there, walk out the gate, then close the gate and keep going, and just sit down and have a rest every now and again, and then keep going, just keep walking out to the horizon, and that's how you get there. I've probably paraphrased that really badly, but there's something really sweet and beautiful to it, especially the little illustrations of this little man walking towards the horizon and a moon in the sky. He kind of owned moons, like that was kind of his thing. He owned the icon of the moon, the half moon that was always in the sky. I always felt like he'd sign his cartoon Loonig down the bottom, but there was always a moon in the sky. I always felt the moon was more his signature than his actual signature. But yeah, as I got older, I discovered other people who tickled me and said stuff, probably like Bukowski in my 30s. I felt like, this guy's just saying the stuff that no one's saying. He's just brutally just putting it down on, he's fucking saying the things that people were just dancing around. Sometimes I feel like Michael Loonig's style kind of danced around things, but as he got older, he didn't so much. Like in the last 5-10 years, he just said it. He said it. But that's kind of his charm as well, because he left it to the imagination. He could almost preach to the unconverted with his absurdist fables that he did. But I did love how Bukowski kind of just went, fuck it, this is how it is. This is fucked. And Bukowski's just the words, no illustration. I felt like it was undiluted, whereas in my 30s and 40s, Michael Loonig's stuff started. I could feel, because he'd mix words and images, I almost felt like the images started to dilute the words. Even though I loved them as a kid, and even though I still love them, I felt like they compromised each other somehow. And I wanted to desperately be a cartoonist back in my teenage years and early 20s just because of him. I thought, oh, fuck, I'd love to fucking be a cartoonist for the age one day. How good would that be? But I wasn't to become a cartoonist, even though I still do little illustrations. I thought, all these people who are my age have got these plum cartoon positions in newspapers and other media when the internet wasn't around, and I'd always come second. I remember The Age actually calling me once saying, Darby, we've got an opening. If you can get an illustration to us in the next hour, you've got it shot. And I remember waking up too late because I was hungover when I was about 30, and that fell through, because they said, no, too late, sorry, we've already put it out to someone else. And it wasn't to be. And so Bukowski's stuff and his poetry made sense to me. I thought, oh, I'm just going to write poetry. So all that stuff, making cartoons and being inspired by Michael Looney, was never wasted. It eventually evolved, and I was attracted to just the simpleness of words on paper, the black and whiteness of that, and how undiluted it felt. And yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that I became a writer or wrote poetry at one point. I don't really think my stuff's poetry anymore. It's almost kind of like maybe poetic observations, but written in kind of vernacular, blah blah. Anyway, that's my weird sort of little thoughts on Michael Looney, and he died a week ago, and it just felt like such an immortal character to me. That guy couldn't die. It's like his stuff is so out there. I feel like the Holy Trinity for me, who were big influential at one point in my life, Alan Watts, Charles Bukowski, and Michael Looney, and they've all had moments in their life, and none of them really resonate with me now, but they all have at some point in a big way. At one point, I swapped some emails with Michael in the last few years, and I just thought I'd read you this email. I asked him, how did he find his voice at such a young age? He came bursting out of the blocks in his late 20s, when a lot of writers find their voice into their late 30s, even 40s, because you've lived enough life to witness the cycles of life, and you can sort of understand the absurdity of it, you can recognise patterns and all that sort of shit. So I wondered how he found his voice so early, and he gave me this response that I'll read. It's a bit long. Darby, that's a good question, and very apt tonight after I have just heard about the death of Barry Humphries. Barry befriended me when I was 25 or 26 and was very kind and encouraging. I was utterly amazed that he wanted to know about a fumbling nobody like me and spend time in my company. Anyway, the point is that the true voice is found when it is heard, listened to, encouraged and appreciated. This is a real blessing. A couple of newspaper editors also did this. Barry did something that my father was unable to do. I love my dad. He taught me much and he was a good man, but I think he was unable to see or understand me at some very deep and important level. And I think he would be the first to agree with me about this. So Barry filled in a few gaps and I was fortunate indeed. But like you, I am an amalgam of my many influences. Paradoxically, I was a sociable, friendly person, but also very much a dreamer and happy outsider, like Holland Caulfield, Catcher in the Rye. My first teacher at school, when I was 5, told my mother, Michael is in a world of his own, so maybe we can be born a bit odd, and maybe our parents do not entirely beat this peculiarity out of us. And of course, this oddness develops its own voice quite naturally, softly, gently, and with little confidence at first, but still a sincere and genuine voice. Add to this a failed but happy enough education and a collection of rugged working class situations, working as a labourer in the meatworks when my mates were at university. I often had to kill cattle. The male rough and tumble of Footscray in the 50s and 60s, my serious brush with military conscription aged 19, the creative fertility of the 1960s, and an innocent devotion to a humble, heartfelt form of Christianity during my adolescence. So you see, there's all this business of finding your footing and making your own peculiar path, and the voice naturally and unconsciously emerges, even though we are not aware of its uniqueness. And then there is good fortune. I was given a job as a cartoonist on a daily newspaper at the age of 24. Indeed, a fluke. 6 political cartoons a week. They miraculously trusted me, even though my only experience had been drawing for underground magazines as an amateur. It was a hard start, and the pressure was on, but I was very keen, and all I had to offer was my own drawing. All I had to offer was my own strange voice. I did not go to art school. This is there is no way you can be trained to be a cartoonist. It has to come from your hands and your own struggling, serious / humorous soul. So, Darby, just a few thoughts here, but not the complete picture. I don't know all the answers and have forgotten many of the details. Maybe your voice comes mainly from God. I hope you can see this word as a poetic word. That's all for now. I'm terribly sad about Barry's death. Cheers anyway, Michael. Anyway, if you'd like to leave a little review for my podcast on Apple or Spotify, I'd love that.